KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, California has by far the largest state delegation in Congress, but how much political juice do we really have? Also, how climate change could threaten the power supply in California, and a very unusual place for protecting endangered species.
We have pocket mice, tarantulas, we got spiders, we got deer, all sorts of good little critters. Leave them alone, all right?
Yes, sir.
Don't mess with anything out there. Don't pick it up. Don't pet it, don't poke it, don't put it in your pocket. It does not want to be your pet.
Plus, using digital technology to preserve the California missions.
It's not about the sites themselves. It's really about the stories, whether it was Manzanar or Angkor Wat or Pompeii. It's about the humanness of these sites.
It's the California Report. With the celebratory dust settled from Monday's presidential inauguration, the Obama administration turns to the work of transforming all that lofty rhetoric into actual policy. The deficit, immigration, gun control, they're all on the front burner. Thursday, California Senator Dianne Feinstein unveiled legislation to ban military-style rifles and large ammunition clips.
Only if you stand up, if America rises up, if people care enough to call every member of the House and every member of the Senate and say, we have had enough. These weapons do not belong on the streets of our towns, our cities, in our schools, in our malls, in our workplaces, in our movie theaters. Enough is enough. We can win this.
What will it take to get that passed, and what role will California's congressional delegation play on that and other issues? Well, those are the kinds of questions the University of California's Washington Center in D.C. asks. I spoke with the center's Mark Sandalo about the state's clout in Congress.
California's clout is based on who's in power. They got 38 Democratic members in Congress, which I believe is twice as much as any other state. Californians are Democrats. So while Republicans control the House of Representatives, they're simply not as powerful. There clearly are some Republicans who have clout. Kevin McCarthy is the whip. He's the number three guy in the House. So there are some Californians with importance. But for California to express its clout in Congress, Democrats need to win the majority.
And that may or may not happen in a couple of years. If it were to happen, I mean, obviously Nancy Pelosi would become Speaker. But as minority leader, you know, there have been two big votes in the last couple of weeks, one on Sandy storm relief and the other on avoiding this fiscal cliff. Both had a majority of Democrat votes. What does that do to, you know, Nancy Pelosi's clout, if anything?
Every time Nancy Pelosi keeps her Democratic Party together, even in the minority, it forces Republicans to do things they might not otherwise want to do. For example, with the aid for the hurricane relief, there are a lot of Republicans who simply didn't want to vote to increase aid for anything. They don't want to spend money. So with John Boehner convincing them, look, I need some of your votes. If Pelosi can keep all of her Democrats in line, she can force more Republicans to do things they don't want to do.
Big issue in this Congress is going to be gun control. Senator Feinstein this week introducing legislation, another assault weapons ban, reducing the size of ammunition clips and so on. How heavy a lift is that going to be politically, and how much power clout does Dianne Feinstein have to get that done?
It's surprising people outside California how difficult gun control is, because these measures would be no-brainers for the most part in the state of California. This was very difficult for Feinstein back in 1994 when she passed it, and some blame her for having Democrats losing the House the following year because of it. It's a huge lift. It's not difficult for urban Democrats and West Coast Democrats, folks, you know, whether they're from Los Angeles or New York, to vote in favor of gun control. It's a different story if you're a Democrat representing a rural district in North Carolina.
On the other hand, you've got Mike Thompson, who represents the northern part of California, the North Coast. He's been leading the charge, helping to lead the charge on gun control, but I guess he's in a safe district, so he doesn't have to worry about casting a tough vote.
Mike Thompson is a Purple Heart winner in Vietnam. He owns guns. He goes hunting. There are an awful lot of people, say in the Bay Area, who'd call him a gun nut. There are people in his district, which extends, you know, past Napa, who just call him a sportsman. The NRA calls him an enemy. They actually gave him an F rating. And the reason is because while he is adamant in protecting the Second Amendment right to bear arms, he's against assault weapons. And if Obama can put people like Mike Thompson forward, Democrats will do very well on this issue.
Another big issue coming up in this Congress, immigration reform. And there's a big expectation that the Republicans are going to come to the table on this. What's at stake in California if immigration reform gets done in a comprehensive way with some sort of path to ultimate citizenship? What difference would it make for California?
California has far more immigrants than any place else, and an awful lot of them are having snuck across the border, don't have documents. And if there is a path towards citizenship, no state will have more immigrants applying for citizenship than California. So it could make an enormous difference. And, you know, this is – Republicans look at this. They look at what happened in California almost a generation ago now, where Pete Wilson, to save his political career, demonized the Mexicans. They keep coming across the border. It worked in the short term, and Democrats have done outstandingly well in California ever since. There is great fear across the nation among Republicans that if they continue to demonize immigrants, they're going to pay the same price.
Mark, the president is going to have a lot of vacancies to fill in his cabinet and throughout government. Who are some of the prominent Californians being mentioned as potential appointments?
The one name everyone talks about is Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. There's an opening in transportation. People expect that Ray LaHood will be retiring. So there's talk that he could do that. You know, when Clinton was president, they talked about how he was essentially – like his other job was governor of California. He loved coming to the Bay Area. He came out to California something like every other month for his presidency. You don't feel the same love from Obama. You know, Obama started his undergraduate career in Southern California. So he has roots to California, and he has loved trips to California during the campaign because California gave – millions and millions of dollars to him. But now that he doesn't have to run for re-election, I'm not sure the connection is as close to California as it has been in other Democratic presidencies.
That's Mark Sandolo. He's Associate Academic Director for the University of California's Washington Center. I spoke with him this week in D.C. One of the other big issues President Obama is pledging to tackle is climate change. And the implications for California are huge. Much of our electricity comes from hydropower projects, taking advantage of steep terrain and gushing mountain rivers to churn out cheap, clean power. But that dependence on heavy snow in the winter and heavy runoff in the spring is threatened by climate change. And as KQED science reporter Molly Samuel says, it's a problem that federal regulators have chosen to ignore.
New Bullards Bar Dam stretches across a steep, rocky canyon in the Sierra Nevada foothills, about 50 miles northeast of Sacramento. It's the fifth highest dam in North America, towering more than 60 stories over the North Yuba River.
And we're standing on top of the spillway, watching the water rush down below us, maybe 100 feet below our feet, and then going down and spilling into the North Yuba River.
Jeff Rabum works for the Yuba County Water Agency, which owns this and other smaller dams, plus a network of reservoirs, water diversion tunnels, and hydroelectric facilities. Rabum works on relicensing for the water agency. Every few decades, hydropower projects have to get a new license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. If you think going to the DMV is bad, be glad you're not a dam. Applying for a new hydropower license takes years and costs millions of dollars. It seems like everything gets considered, from how the dams affect water supply to endangered species to whitewater sports.
We have 44 different studies going on right now.
In the end, the new license will dictate how much electricity the project generates and how much water it releases, and when, for the next 30 to 50 years. That's why there are so many studies and why FERC relicensing is so important to water agencies, power companies, and environmental groups, among others. But there's one looming issue that Rabone doesn't have to wrangle any studies for: climate change. FERC doesn't require those. Steve Rothard is California director for the environmental organization American Rivers. He's asked FERC to include climate change in the relicensing process, but they've turned him down.
It's an approach akin to the cliche of putting their heads in the sand.
Climate change projections for the Sierra Nevada vary. The region may get wetter, it may get drier, but scientists agree it will get warmer, dramatically affecting the snow where most of the region's water comes from. And not in the distant future. There's evidence we're already seeing effects of climate change in the Sierra.
And yet, the power companies and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission refuse to consider how climate change will affect these dams and these rivers for the next 50 years.
Josh Veers is an ecologist at the University of California, Davis. He argues that FERC's decision to depend only on historic weather and water records doesn't make sense anymore, especially for licenses that won't expire for decades.
Most of the projections for California in particular, and these are multiple scientists using different models and different assumptions, all converge on the same idea that the climate 35 years from now is not likely to be what we see today.
One recent study suggests the emergence of a new normal within the next few decades, one in which 8 in 10 winters in the western U.S. will see snow accumulation below what we now consider normal. Veers says the way California manages water will have to change. Right now, the snowpack itself serves as a reservoir. If it melts earlier or if more precipitation falls as rain, our man-made reservoirs may have to spill the extra runoff, which could mean more floods in the winter and more water shortages in the summer.
We have a lot at stake, and so it seems that it would be in the public's best interest if, in fact, FERC were looking out for the public.
So we went to FERC and asked them, why not take climate change into account?
There are not really any models yet that are granular enough that we would feel comfortable basing a decision on the impact of climate change on an individual facility.
John Norris is a FERC commissioner.
What the impact's going to be on that individual facility is a very different analysis than a kind of a broad global theory of the impact of climate change.
Jeff Raybone from the Yuba County Water Agency says even though federal regulators don't require climate change studies, that doesn't mean it's not on his mind.
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens if climate change turns out the way that it's theorized to work out.
If it does, the job of water managers balancing the needs of fish, farmers, and power plants will only get more complicated as the climate changes, whether or not regulators are paying attention. For the California Report, I'm Molly Samuel in Yuba County.
Want to see a map of all the hydropower projects in the state? Just go to californiareport.org. Southern California's coast is one of the most densely populated places in all of America, and development there has, over decades, eaten up wildlife habitats. But there's one big exception, 125,000 acres of open space that's become a kind of Noah's Ark for the coast's endangered species, the last place many of them can live. And as Valerie Hamilton explains, they've got some unlikely landlords.
There are 16 endangered species living in this wilderness, odd birds, rare rodents, and one persistent toad. But at sunset, it sounds like the frogs are here all by themselves. They're not.
Aye, sir! Aye, sir!
Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton might not seem like your first choice for a nature preserve. But on the heavily developed Southern California coast, you take what you can get.
If you look to the north of us, to Orange County, or you look to the south of us, to Oceanside and beyond, you see nothing but condos and businesses and infrastructure.
Sherry Sullivan is a biologist. She was hired by the military to help protect the endangered species on base.
Camp Pendleton is 18 miles of almost undeveloped coastline. We have populations of wildlife almost on an island where the surrounding communities don't.
Take the Pacific pocket mouse, known in military speak as the PPM. PPMs used to live all along the coast from LA to Mexico, but development squeezed them out decades ago. Now there are so few of them left in the wild that up until 1993, biologists thought they were extinct. Virtually the last place they've survived is Camp Pendleton. This evening on the base, about 300 recruits are setting out on an all-night training mission. Part of their safety briefing goes like this.
We have snakes, we have pocket mice, tarantulas, we got spiders, we got deer, all sorts of good little critters. Leave them alone, all right?
Yes, sir.
Don't mess with anything out there. Don't pick it up. Don't pet it. Don't poke it. Don't put it in your pocket. It does not want to be your pet.
Now, if you're imagining little mousies dodging combat boots outside the mess hall, don't. The Endangered Species Act means the Marines have to watch their step and work around where the PPMs live.
In this area here, you can see some tail drags, little footprints.
Sherry Sullivan shows me clumps of sage scrub in the sandy ground. Recruits use this area for marches, but because of the pocket mouse, they're supposed to stay on the road. Sullivan says the other PPM habitat on base gets even less traffic, but for different reasons.
Where the Pacific pocket mouse are situated next to the marksmanship range, they don't get impacted because nobody walks back there. Nobody wants to get hit by a stray bullet.
For the Pacific pocket mouse, the back of the shooting range may be as good as it gets, but it's not good enough.
If you step on their burrows, they could be squished because they only burrow down a few inches. So anytime you're doing anything on the land where the pocket mouse thrive, you're having a potential impact.
With only three known PPM colonies, two at Camp Pendleton and one in nearby Dana Point, inbreeding, a fire, or just bad luck could destroy the species for real this time. Scientists know so little about them that it's hard to guess what the wider impact could be. What they do know is the Pacific pocket mouse is hanging on by a thread.
Much like the California condors, where there were only a handful left in the wild, chances that this species will blip out are very good.
And so, 30 miles away at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, biologists are working on what you might call a strategic pocket mouse reserve.
Here he is. It's male 8. He's probably around 6.5 grams, probably about the size of a thumb.
Last summer, Deborah Shire led a team of researchers on nighttime mouse missions on Camp Pendleton. The base helps finance the Institute's work. Now the 22 PPMs they captured are safe and sound in plexiglass cages, ready to breed the next generation.
Captive breeding is sort of our last-ditch effort at recovery.
The idea is to produce more mice in a safe, controlled environment and then release them to start new PPM colonies in the wild. It's risky, but the hope is the mice will multiply and prosper, enough so they're delisted, not endangered anymore, on base or off. Base biologist Sherry Sullivan says that would be good news for everyone.
If the species are delisted, we don't have to have the intense management. We have more freedom to conduct more activities on that land space.
You might think the Pacific pocket mouse would be better off without the military. Biologist Will Miller of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says, on the contrary.
Probably the survival of the species has been greatly enhanced by Camp Pendleton and the fact that they maintain their land as open space and do some limited training on that land.
With any luck, the first baby mice will be born in captivity this spring. But for now, the only thing standing between the Pacific pocket mouse and extinction may be the U.S. Marines. For the California Report, I'm Valerie Hamilton.
In the 1980s, the band Camper Van Beethoven came out of Santa Cruz with wry and musically witty observations of scenes around the state, like the bluegrass Balkan ska punk song Take the Skinheads Bowling, for example. According to the California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman, a new album by the group, its first in 9 years, has all those early qualities and more.
Last year we had the young Los Angeles duo Best Coast singing about California on its album, The Only Place, with the musical question, why would you live anywhere else? Now veteran band Camper Van Beethoven, with its new album La Costa Perdida, is asking the same thing, but coming from Camper Van Beethoven, it's a much more complicated question.
The sea and the shore, forever entwined, they all sing the same song. Please come down the coast. Esmeralda, come down and see me sometime.
Come Down the Coast opens this outing, the starting point of a journey along the album title's lost shoreline. That's lost not as in physically eroded, but emotionally, spiritually worn, ghostly. With camper singer-songwriter David Lowry behind the wheel, it's a road trip that finds everyone is somewhere else or sometime else. song after song tinged with a sadness. Well, Lowry and some of his bandmates, too, are among the missing. He's been living in Virginia for some years. Now, he would never be so mundane as to write about trying to recapture what he's lost, but in that light, he's among those hearing the siren's call of the album's centerpiece song, Northern California Girls, the women pleading for the exiles to come home from Texas, come home from Brooklyn. This is not the lure of the Beach Boys' California Girls of 50 years ago. It's not a Grateful Dead sunshine daydream. That's gone.
Northern California girls say, baby, come home now. You don't belong there. Everybody knows it's but you. Don't you miss the ocean? Don't you miss the weather?
Even Peaches in the Summertime, as idyllic as it sounds, is a somber tale of unfulfilled and illicit desire. Its very title echoes Steinbeck in its allusions to and illusions of forbidden fruit here in paradise. It also recalls Tom Joad and his immigrant heirs in its poetic emotional ties to ballads of displacement from the old world, whether the old world is Oklahoma or Oaxaca or somewhere even more distant.
When I was a boy, all I wanted was
But that's the thing about California. Every old world is here. Every tradition is represented. That's the wide-open cultural field that fueled Camper Van Beethoven's music in the first place. In that regard, the MVP now, as then, is violinist Jonathan Siegel. His fluid flights and boundless musical reach take Camper in unexpected and unexpectedly delightful directions, with its Hendrix meets Zeppelin rock, spiked by side trips into prog rock hoedowns or something like that.
La Costa Perdida?
Maybe we are all lost here, but David Lowry and his Camper cohorts, after all these years, find it a very rich place in which to be lost, or be one of the lost. And in the end, they may not have a good answer to the not-so-rhetorical question, why would we live anywhere else?
Broken Spanish in the daytime, picking fruit with campesinos. I'm a half güero, caballero, Yankee, from a town just south of Brawley.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music. He reviewed La Costa Perdida by Camper Van Beethoven.
I know I look familiar. Brother, you don't want to know.
San Francisco's Mission Dolores is one in a network of 21 missions connected by El Camino Real, the historic route stretching 600 miles between Sonoma and San Diego. An Oakland-based company called SciArc is creating a digital version of El Camino Real and helping communities preserve the history of the missions. The Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, bring us the story as part of KQED's community documentary project, The Making Of, about what people make in the Bay Area and why.
Some people think Camino Real means the Royal Road of Jesus in California. No, it's the King's Highway, the King of Spain's Highway. I'm Andrew Galvin, curator of Mission Dolores, San Francisco. If you step out the front door of Mission Dolores, you would be on the Camino Real. It was a public road, like Interstate 101. All the California missions are connected. Wherever you got on it, it led you to the Viceroy's Palace in Mexico City.
SciArc is making a virtual El Camino Real that links the 21 missions from San Diego to Sonoma. We use a 3D laser scanner that sends out a pulsed laser beam and captures billions of points of these structures at a rate of about 100,000 points a second. I am Elizabeth Lee. I direct operations at SIARC. SIARC has digitally preserved over 70 sites around the world, from Pompeii in Italy to Tikal in Guatemala. We're a nonprofit organization founded by Ben and Barbara Casera.
I'm Barbara Casera. Ben and I started this foundation after we sold our technology company that developed the laser scanning system. It was right at the time that the Bamiyan Buddhas were blown up by the Taliban. There was no three-dimensional documentation of them. We said, how can we use this technology to help architects, preservationists, get a better tool than a tape measure and a clipboard and a pencil to go in and document these heritage sites?
Sometimes new things are revealed. Like in the case here of Mission Dolores, we're working hard to get behind this very ornate false wall near the altar, which contains these frescoes that were painted by the Indians who helped build this mission.
There's about a 2-foot space behind the wood frame where the statues are today. Very few have ever seen what's behind. Using fiber optics, they'll be able to get a little pin needle and be able to photograph. Then you'd be able to click on St. Joachim with your smartphone, and boom, you'll be able to see behind, floor to ceiling, the mural painted by the Indians here at Mission Dolores in the year 1791.
It's not about the sites themselves. It's really about the stories, whether it was Manzanar or Angkor Wat or Pompeii. It's about the humanness of these sites.
There's almost 6,000 Indians buried in our cemetery. If you walk around and look at the grave markers, you're going to read the history of San Francisco. The 21 Alta California missions are cultural heritage sites. These are our monuments. The digital El Camino Real is about digitally imaging, about preservation, but it's also about interpretation of what happened to the California missions.
The Making Of is produced by the Kitchen Sisters with KQED and AIR for the Localore Project, funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can hear more stories in the series. Just follow the link on our website, californiareport.org. And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and of course, we're on Facebook as well. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Klein. Our interns are Guy Maserati and Gina Shalaba. The associate senior producer is Victoria Malione. Craig Miller was a contributing editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, health happens with prevention at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.